Today is Wednesday, December 16th, 2020. This is the Apple Context Machine. I'm Brian Chaffin. That's Ichabod. Commander Ichabod checking in with Mr. Stoat. Anyway, the Apple Context Machine, that's a podcast for the Mac Observer. I am still Brian Chaffin, who is, by reputable accounts, both all that and a bag of chips. I think that's what the kids say these days. To get the full story on anything that, we cover in this podcast, you can visit macobserver.com/ACM. And if you'd like to comment on or question anything about the show, you can shoot me a note over at macobserver.com/context machine. That'll take you to our Facebook group. We have a first. While on the one hand, I have Jeff on to co-host today's episode, but on the other, it's a different Jeff. It is one Jeff Butts. Jeff?
That's me. Hey, Brian.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
For sure, for sure. And speaking of having, we have BetterHelp sponsoring this week's show. I appreciate them very much. I'm going to tell you more about them, including how to get a discount on their services. Jeff, I happen to know two things. Well, I know a couple things.
Yeah, I would think so.
Yeah. Two of those things are the reality that you are freshly into, essentially newly, recently getting into cryptocurrencies, and that cryptocurrencies are, of course, ripping up the charts again. And I thought it would be interesting to talk about cryptocurrencies with you as a person who is newly into them and newly learning about them.
Okay.
Yes. So I like today, and this is actually kind of coincidental to you being here, but and as of like this writing, Bitcoin is sitting at $20,663. It was up to $20,800. I don't know, about an hour ago, it's rocketed up today.
Yeah.
And many of the cryptos have rallied. I should also mention that I've got a very small holding of Bitcoin. I've got some Cardano. I've got a couple of Litecoin. I've got a few Dash. All small holdings, and they. And I have a couple of shares of Apple, and none of this stuff has ever affected the way I talk about these companies, but I want to make sure that you, my listeners, know that so that you can actually judge what I say as you will. Have any holdings?
I do. I'm kind of kicking myself that I didn't have anything in Bitcoin last night. But I do have some small holdings in Cosmos and Tezos.
Okay. I don't know much about either of those.
Those are newer. They're basically currencies that are using, that are more tied to Ethereum than Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. And they're using their own platforms and they do staking staking rewards on Coinbase.
So they're doing proof of work. Excuse me,
proof of stake, right? Proof of stake, and on Coinbase, at least if you're in the Coinbase Earn program, you get rewards for how much you hold.
Well, are they proof of stake, or is this just like are they doing something like BlockFi? Where you can borrow.
You would have to ask me that, wouldn't you?
Well, yeah, it's kind of, and we're throwing around a lot of terms. We should, let's actually clarify some of this stuff. Proof of stake. Let's start right there. Proof of stake versus proof of work. Mm-hmm. Bitcoin is a proof of work cryptocurrency. And what that means is that computers are competing with each other to do the math that is used to keep the platform accurate and honest.
Right.
And the way Bitcoin was designed, and it was rather genius. It's one of the many things that the original Bitcoin team brought to the world, but it's also insidious at the same time. I mean, because it turns out there are some interesting repercussions of this, but it's designed so that we got to back up a little bit. So with a blockchain and with Bitcoin, a transaction is sent across the network, and to make sure that the transaction is legitimate, to make sure that, for instance, someone hasn't already spent or sent those Bitcoins.
He is
ripping it up over there.
I could hear. He's having a good time.
He is having a great time. And Mr.
He's excited about the market being up in crypto.
Yeah, and Mr. Moose's spine is taking the brunt of that excitement. Everything is encrypted, and the network uses math to do that encryption and also to authenticate it. Right. And in reward for doing that math, the blockchain releases a new block of that includes newly minted Bitcoins.
Mm-hmm.
And to make sure that all the Bitcoins don't get like minted at one time, the network is set up to automatically make that math artificially harder or artificially easier, depending on how many computers, how much processing power is being thrown at the task.
Right.
And that is like super clever and nifty. But the problem is that we now have a significant amount of the world's electricity consumption going to the Bitcoin network. To mention the insane number of specialized computing devices that do nothing other than do this math that we're talking about, or at least that I'm monologuing about. And to sort of change that, there's another system that has come into play. Multiple cryptocurrencies use this, and it's called proof of stake. And with proof of stake, instead of the network artificially increasing or decreasing its math, what the blockchain for these proof of stake cryptocurrencies do is require the computers who are vying to do the math to show that the owners hold some cryptocurrency.
Mm-hmm.
And the network ends up assigning one of the proof of stake holders the privilege of doing the math for a set period of time, and they still get a reward, but it's the network choosing from among the people who were showing that stake, who have that proof of stake. And what that does is it keeps the network from escalating and from you know, having this inflationary effect where you need to throw more and more and more and more and more and more and more computers. And it is much more environmentally friendly, and it still provides protections to keep the network legit.
Right.
So that's usually what staking refers to.
Both Tezos and Cosmos are based on the proof of stake consensus.
Got it. And are they both running on the Ethereum chain?
That I'm not 100% sure on. Tezos, yes, I'm pretty sure.
That's TESOS, is that right?
TEZOS.
TEZOS, yes, of course. I knew that. Yes, of course. Is that TEZOS?
That's correct, yes. Tezos, I'm assuming it's based on Ethereum.
Let's find out.
Okay.
I am not sure that it is. I would have researched this. I didn't realize you were holding Tezos.
Well, you know.
Liquid proof stick model. Peer to peer. It doesn't say. It does not say that. Wikipedia does not say that it's Ethereum based.
I'm looking at Tezos' page itself.
Yeah.
I don't really know enough about it yet to say for sure.
But you own some.
Yeah, I know. I own some primarily because I got it mostly for free.
Oh, that's nice.
Using because of Coinbase's the Coinbase platform, as you know, and many of our listeners might already know, there are when a new or an upcoming cryptocurrency gets added to Coinbase's platform, sometimes they'll give you ways that you can earn that particular one for free.
Yeah.
By learning about it. And I learned about it some time ago. And because I'm old, I've forgotten most of what I learned.
Oh, that's nice. That's great. Yeah. So it looks like Tezos is not built on Ethereum, and Cosmos is also not built on Ethereum. Cosmos is built on Tendermint, which is I'm not familiar with Tendermint.
Okay.
I'm seeing that Cosmos is a proof of work system. Oh no, wait, hold on. Bitcoin and Ethereum. Okay, I'm sorry, I misread this little blurb.
Cosmos is a proof of stake chain,
and I'm a big believer in that. Cardano ADA is a proof of stake platform. Ethereum is possibly moving to proof of stake. Bitcoin is not likely to ever move to proof of stake because changes to Bitcoin are controlled by the miners, the people who operate the computers doing all this math.
Right.
And it turns out they have a vested interest in keeping everything just like it is.
Oh, yeah.
Because
they've got the resources to throw electricity at it.
Well, they not only have that, but they've already done so. That's the thing, is like there's sunk costs into what they have. And if they were to move over to a proof of stake system, they would lose all of their power and ability to get newly minted Bitcoins.
Right. And one huge difference with Tezos and Cosmos and I think any proof of stake is that changes to the protocol or the currency are voted on by everyone who has stake in that currency.
Yeah, most of the proof of stake systems, most of the proof of stake cryptocurrencies do essentially give voting power to the holders.
Right.
As opposed to the miners.
Right. Now, in my case, I have signed over my vote to Coinbase, and in return, they give me free money.
Okay.
You know, it's not much, but as I invest more, it will become more. Right now, through Coinbase, I'm getting 4.63% APY on Tezos and 5% API on Cosmos.
Yeah, what are they? But why is are those related to minting rewards, or are they doing something with it?
Related to what rewards?
Minting rewards. Like, I mean, so for instance, in Cardano, I've got my Cardano staked within, and Cardano. I'm a huge fan of Cardano, and one of the reasons is because you can stake to a pool right from within your wallet. And so your Cardano never leaves your possession. It's merely pledged for 5-day epics at a time. I'm sorry, 5-day epics at a time.
Okay.
And it's super easy. And so the rewards that I get from staking my Cardano are directly related to the rewards that go for, you know, doing all that math that we talked about.
Right.
And so where are the rewards coming from for Tezos and Cosmos?
In Tezos, the rewards come from what's called baking, which is very similar to minting. It's signing and publishing the blocks to the blockchain. And the bakers make sure that all the transactions are right, that the order is agreed on, that there's no double spending. And if you agree to become a baker, then you get additional Tezos for helping secure the network.
I see.
And so I have, you know, assigned that right over to Coinbase. So they get a percentage back from Tezos, and then they pass on 4.63% of that per year to me.
I see that. Yeah.
Cosmos, I think, works in the same way, probably different terminology, but it's once again, it's because I'm allowing Coinbase A to vote on my behalf and B.
Yeah, it is. I'm looking at it. It is based on the proof of stake rewards from securing the network, as you mentioned earlier. So that is for sure the case with Cosmos, and I'm confirming.
I know it's the case with Tezos because I just read it. Yep.
So what brought you to this in the first place? Because you did not, to my knowledge, you didn't do this because, like, I'd been going on about it.
Right. I had stayed away from it for a long time because it seemed to me like it was a form of gambling, and I try to stay away from that. And it is, yeah.
I mean, but in the same way that any form of stock investing is also a form of gambling. And don't get me wrong, there is buying and holding,
mm-hmm.
which is less of a gamble, but is still technically a kind of gamble. And then there's doing stuff like playing with options. And that is just straight up. That's straight up gambling.
And I don't mess with options. But I've gone into... I've become an entrepreneur as well as a writer and a tech addict. And so one of the things I've done in my entrepreneurial efforts is finding ways to fund our projects in the middle of this COVID-19 mess where finding money isn't the way it used to be.
Okay.
And so I got involved in Bitcoin arbitrage.
Also which gambling. Is where
it is, but I'm doing it on a short-term basis where
also gambling.
I only I only buy the Bitcoin when I have a buyer for it. And I already know what that buyer is going to pay me for it.
Okay.
So I don't know that it's really gambling other than the fact that from day to day, my ability to complete good trades can vary based on how much Bitcoin is.
And arbitrage is the idea of buying from a source where you can buy it at a price that is lower than another source where you could sell it.
Right.
And arbitrage applies to anything, like, you know, any, like, you know, people that go and buy things at TJ Maxx and then, you know, sell them on eBay or Amazon at a higher price. That is a form of arbitrage.
Right. And it mixes up, you know, there are countries where it is more difficult to buy crypto than it is here.
Yeah.
And so, you know, but they can buy other things like Amazon gift cards or you know, Best Buy gift cards or whatever. And I'll do exchanges that way too, where I'll buy the Bitcoin and then I'll sell it for, you know, an Amazon gift card. I just have to be, I have to be very, very careful who I'm dealing with when I do that though.
Yeah, for sure. I don't recommend that at all. Anyone listening to this, I do not recommend that you do what Jeff is talking about.
It is a really good way to get taken, because there's a lot of fraudsters out there that will buy or steal these gift cards and then use them to get Bitcoin. So you have to be very, very careful. And, you know, if you don't know cybersecurity and fraud prevention, you've got to just don't do it.
Yes. And certainly don't do anything that we're talking about because we're talking about it. You make sure you're doing your own due diligence. Be very careful. There's a lot of volatility in the cryptocurrency markets, and you know you should never be investing any money in cryptocurrencies, just like stocks, that you can't afford to lose.
Right.
That should always be the case with just about anything you're doing that includes any kind of investment. But I would say that doubly, triply, quadruply, quintuply applies to doing anything in the crypto space. It is highly volatile. Like today, Bitcoin has went from, I don't know, I think it was 19,400 when I went to bed, and you know, and then here it is 12 hours later and it's at 19,000 or 20,600. I mean, that's a ridiculous pop. And you know, go ahead.
I showed $20,708.54. Well,
there you go. Back up a little bit already. And we should mention in 2017, Bitcoin jumped up to $20,000. And in this massive bubble that then popped, and over the course of the next 6-8 months, it fell to as low as $3,000.
Did it actually hit 20,000 or just come close to it?
I think it was like 19,850. Okay. Or if it hit 20, it was for about like 2 seconds. Like one person.
I don't think it hit long enough to register, because the articles I've read today all said that this was a first in history for Bitcoin.
Yeah, that maybe
to break the 20K mark.
But it was super close for like, you know, 4 minutes, and then it started tumbling at that point.
And why is that happening, Brian? I mean, there hasn't been any big news to drive it.
The big news that appears to be the case is simply that there are institutional investors piling money into Bitcoin. And this has been the case throughout this rise. Bitcoin has risen quite a bit this year alone. And that institutional money has been, and when I say institutional money, I'm talking about basically large investors, hedge funds. The JP Morgan is now not scoffing at Bitcoin. There are some other Wall Street vehicles that are piling money into Bitcoin. There was some news today. You were telling me about something today that hit.
Yeah. A fund. Well, two funds that I know of. One is on the London Stock Exchange. It is Ruffer Illiquid Multi-Strategies Fund 2015.
Otherwise known as Gambling LLC.
Right, yeah.
Actually, that is not the case. No one knows that company as that name. I'm completely being a smartass.
Yeah.
Just to be clear.
But, you know, their fund has about $1.5 billion invested. And based on an interim filing in the International Stock Exchange, they may have in the past quarter transferred at least 37.5 million of that to Bitcoin.
Mm. Which is not a lot, but there are other folks who are doing the same thing.
Right.
And
it's about 2.5% of their portfolio is what they're the firm is saying that they're doing. And they say it's a defensive move that they made in November after reducing their exposure to gold.
Hmm. That's interesting. What is gold currently? Let me look. Because gold and silver have been are also up. Gold is at $1,856. Right. It's $1,856. It's down $3 on the day. Silver's at $2,493. I've got a little bit of silver that I've bought over the years. I'm a numismatist. And as part of a new, being,
bless
a,
you.
Thank you. As part of being a numismatist, I've also got some silver bars and coins, small amounts of them.
Oh, okay.
And silver was languishing in the $14 to $17, $18 range for years and years and years, and here it is today at $24.93.
Right.
So there's been and you know, the stock markets are doing well too, and that's in part
they
because.
Are.
The rich have done quite well with this pandemic.
Yep. Well, here,
or
here's
during, an I'm even sorry, bigger. Have done well during the pandemic. That is a
yeah
more accurate.
Not with we don't want to say that they're exploiting it. Sidebar: some of them probably are.
Sure.
But in even bigger news, though, Alan Howard, who is a billionaire hedge fund manager, he's backing an investment firm that's looking to allocate as much as $1 billion to Bitcoin and Ether by early next year.
Okay.
They've so
that's,
already
that's more institutional money.
Yes. And in November, this firm, it's called One River Asset Management. It completed its startup in November with more than $600 million in Bitcoin and Ether.
Hmm.
And Alan Howard, who's co-founder of Brevin
million.
Howard.
Right.
$600 million, yeah, with an M. And Alan Howard, who co-founded Brevin Howard Asset Management, is backing that. And like I said, they're looking at early next year as much as $1 billion. With a B, as in
right.
Roy.
But to us mere mortals, that's a lot of money. In the world of the stock market, that's, you know, nothing. I mean, don't forget that Apple is worth well over $1 trillion.
Right.
But the Bitcoin market cap is, as of this moment, 385, just shy of 385 billion.
Yeah.
Which isn't a lot. And it does make these monies that we're talking about coming into the market, it doesn't take a lot to necessarily move the price of Bitcoin one way or the other. And
right.
We should also point out that the next biggest cryptocurrency, which is Ethereum, competing, mm-hmm. it's a different cryptocurrency. It's the next biggest one, and its market cap is only $70.9 billion.
So right.
There's a huge gap between number one and number two, and number three jumps all the way down to $23.4 billion.
Mm-hmm.
And there's another decrease to less than $20 billion for number four. And then if you get down to Litecoin, which is currently number five, it drops all the mm-hmm. way down to just under $6 billion. So
yeah.
there are huge discrepancies, and these markets still, while they're big, they're not big.
No, they're not. And, you know, the two that I'm holding right now are, I think, number 11 and number 13. Tezos has a market cap of $1.8 billion. Cosmos, $1.1 billion. But what I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the more traditional financial institutions, like the investment firms, the hedge funds, And it's worth even mentioning PayPal. They're new to cryptocurrency.
Right, which means new money coming into it to get it.
Right.
And so there is a huge... We actually have to go back to 2017. There was a whole lot of... most of the money that was pumping Bitcoin and the other cryptocurrency... Like, okay, actually, let's look at Dash. Dash is... I've got a soft spot for Dash. It is super okay. fast, but it also has this ability to essentially hide where the Dash came from, which makes it a favorite for criminal organizations.
Right.
It's but I find the technology really, really interesting. And it was at $800 in 2017 during the bubble. Mm-hmm. And right now it has risen to $102. So it's, you know, 1/8 of its high, whereas Bitcoin is at its high. I just kind of wanted to mention that. There's another thing I want to mention about all this, which is the fact that one of the things that we're seeing with cryptocurrencies is the introduction of cryptocurrencies that solve an actual problem. And so like the problem that Litecoin was the first so-called altcoin, in other words, not Bitcoin. And the problem that it solved was simply being resistant to systems on a chip doing the math. That's not a huge problem. I mean that doesn't solve. That's what am I trying to say? Thank you, Ichabod.
Well, what do you mean by solving a problem? You mean solving a problem of minting or solving a real world problem?
No, a real world problem where, for instance, a Chainlink. One of the things that Chainlink does is it's trying to bridge. Let me get a better description here before I mess this up. It is trying to. Chainlink is actually one of those cryptocurrencies that I keep meaning to check out and learn a whole lot more about. And I haven't done it yet. So it's a good thing I'm talking about it here on the podcast. It is. Trying to solve one of the smart contract issues where blockchain technology can be one of its biggest potentials is in doing so-called smart contracts where essentially the terms of the contract being met are handled sort of automatically and making for secure agreements that are trustless, trustless meaning that no one party has to trust another party.
Right.
And having trustless, the ability to make trustless agreements, trustless transactions, trustless smart contracts is huge from, you know, essentially doing people with, doing business with people that you don't know.
Right.
Ethereum also is trying to solve problems, especially relating to smart contracts. Cardano takes that one step further by not only doing smart contracts, but allowing all kinds of additional engines to sort of be built on top of and into the blockchain. Ethereum is doing some of that too. And so what we're seeing is with some of these altcoins, some of these alternative cryptocurrencies is simply the people taking the concepts introduced by Bitcoin and then thinking about what else they can do with them.
Right.
And
well,
that's important.
Yeah, it is. And it's going beyond just solving problems on the blockchain or doing the math, Filecoin is actually, they're actually developed and are developing a decentralized file storage network. Think Dropbox, but without a central server farm holding all your, or several central server farms holding your files.
Yeah.
Instead, it's distributed, it's peer-to-peer, and the Filecoin cryptocurrency is used as payment for long-term, reliable file storage.
Yeah. And you can get free Filecoin on Coinbase by taking one of their tutorials, rewarded tutorials.
Yes. Absolutely. And
by the way, so we will put our Coinbase and maybe our band invite codes in the show notes.
Yeah.
So and you can choose one of ours if you are interested in opening a Coinbase account and or taking various tutorials that they're offering, and we get something for that and you get something for that. And so, you know, giddy up. But
yep.
Obviously you can just go sign up for Coinbase on your own too.
One of the things I'm thinking about is I have two Raspberry Pis sitting around doing really nothing. Mm-hmm. I may turn one of those, if it's viable, I may turn one of those into a Filecoin storage unit.
Okay.
And I'll have to let you know how that works out.
Yeah, please do. I'm right about that.
Of course.
Going back to the 2017 bubble, there was a whole lot of buying during the 2017 bubble because people were buying, mm-hmm. and a whole bunch of bandwagon jumping. It was, you know, if there was ever a lot of people have tried to compare Bitcoin to the tulip. Was it Dutch or Belgium? Where were tulips in the Renaissance? You know what I'm talking about?
No, I'm afraid I don't.
So there was this big thing on tulips. Tulips became super value, and it was Dutch, yeah. And so people were buying tulips because they kept going up in value, and then people would buy tulips because they kept going up in value, which made people buy tulips because they kept going up in value. And there's obviously an end to that.
It right? really sounds like you're being redundant all over again.
It does, in fact. And what it did is it created this ridiculous bubble. This was in, I think, the 1630s. Is that right? So from 1600 to 7... It's in the 17th century.
Okay.
Okay. So the prices collapsed in 1637. And it was just, you know, like vast fortunes were both earned and lost with tulip mania in the Netherlands in the 17th century on tulips. And have been often people trying to compare Bitcoin to tulip mania. And okay. The reality is, I don't think that comparison is usually accurate. However, in 2017, that bubble was very similar because a whole lot of people were buying because a whole lot of people were buying. And that is, you know, essentially the definition of a bubble. And I don't think that's what we're seeing right now. What we're seeing right now is institutional money flowing into cryptocurrencies, in part because there are new cryptocurrencies that are solving real world problems.
Right.
And in part because they see the utility of it. And
yeah.
So I don't think that 2020 is going to be like 2017, but of course at any moment the institutional investors could all decide to pull their money too.
Right. And you know, in all fairness, I think I should point out that it's really not a bubble until it pops. It could be that this is, you know, an ongoing long-term expansion as opposed to a bubble that's going to pop and we see the values plummet.
Yeah, it could.
It could.
We could be at the. I mean, Dave and I, for instance, have long publicly said that in 5 years, in any given moment, like we've said that in 5 years, Bitcoin could be at $1 million. It could be at $50,000. It could be at $20,000. It could be at $0.
Right.
And that remains the case. But to Jeff's point, this current increase that we're seeing does seem to be driven by different factors than the 2017 FOMO bubble.
Right.
And I hope that we're seeing, you know, foundational increases here and not bubble stuff, but it, you know, yeah. Obviously time will tell.
Yep. Yes, sir.
Time will tell. All right. Good luck on your cryptocurrency path.
Thank you.
I got into Bitcoin faucets because I wanted to get Bitcoin and didn't have any money to buy any Bitcoin with.
Yeah.
And I do have my TMO faucet guide. It's in need of an updating right now. I'll have the link to that in the show notes too. But it is a way to get tiny amounts of crypto, very, very, very tiny amounts of cryptocurrency for essentially loading up a web page.
Right.
And then there's also another aspect of that I've become familiar with, which is offer walls, where you do tasks like surveys or even get paid to install an app and get it to a certain level because they're hoping to make you a game player, for instance. And get rewarded for it. And you can get more cryptocurrency doing those things than you can doing a faucet. But I cover some of those in my faucet guide too. So I'll have the link to that in the show notes.
I suspect that we can get more too from like Coinbase's own rewards program.
Yeah, well, yeah.
From faucets.
From faucets for sure. Faucets faucets are very tiny amounts of Bitcoin, and you know it. But at the same time, you can keep doing the faucets, and the
right.
The tutorials are finite.
Yes.
Right. Okay.
Yep,
so
that's true.
Let me tell you about BetterHelp. That is our sponsor this week. BetterHelp, it's affordable, private, online counseling. Get it anytime, get it anywhere. I mentioned before, I'm a huge believer in this. I think this stuff is important. Being able to get professional counseling remotely, you can do it by video, you can do it by phone, right? Being able to get this stuff remotely is very important, especially in the time of COVID. Very, very important. And I'm so happy that they're sponsoring us. I'm so happy I get to mention, and I'm happy that I get to offer you a discount too. This company they're committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches that make it easy and free to change counselors if you need to. You can end up communicating with them within 24 hours of signing up. Services available all over the world. And they have a broad range of expertise, some of which may or may not be available to you locally. Their licensed professional counselors include, their specializations even include depression, stress, anxiety, relationships, sleeping, trauma, anger, family conflicts, LGBT issues, grief, and self-esteem. Of course, anything you share is confidential with them. It's very convenient. Like I said, it's very professional. They also make it affordable. I would very much love it if you checked them out, or if you have someone that's close to you that needs some help, that you tell them about this. Like I said, I very much appreciate them sponsoring us. And because you are an ACM listener, you can get 10% off of your first month by visiting our sponsor at betterhelp.com/ACM. It's just right there. You'll see a welcome message says, welcome, Apple Context Machine listeners, just right there. You can join over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health. And again, that's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ACM. Okay, Jeff, let's also, there's something else that's been interesting and a little bit of a change. And again, it's something that you're kind of new to. Is the world of trade shows. I mean, CES is coming up. And, you know, I personally think that last year's, 2020, this year's actually, CES, the one that took place in January, was a super spreader, was the original super spreader event outside of China for COVID.
Okay.
I don't have any proof of that. I don't know if any studies have been done about that, but I certainly have read some very interesting anecdotal tales about last year's CES. And of course, this year's CES, the one coming up in January in 2021, will not be an in-person event.
Correct.
It'll be a virtual event. And
100% virtual. Everything is online. I think probably using Zoom, but I don't know that for a fact.
Some companies may be using some other things, but still basically CES is working on finding a way, or has found a way, to stay relevant at a time when you know we can't bring a couple hundred thousand of our closest industry friends together in one place under multiple roofs in Las Vegas.
And you know, it's exciting for me on a personal level because I could never go to CES in Las Vegas. Yeah. I just couldn't.
Right.
And so, you know, now in 2021, for the first time ever, I can actually go to CES.
Right.
So, you know, it's really cool. You know, it's unfortunate. You know, this pandemic is terrible. It's horrible. It's killing people almost every day. But it's also changing the way we live. And I think in a lot of ways, it's bringing us together more than really anything ever has.
Well, it's bringing us together in different ways. And it's still and it's still stressful. And there is, I believe there's still a lot of value in getting in-person, face-to-face contact with the people you're doing business with. And that's both from the standpoint of us as journalists covering new product announcements, but also the manufacturers talking to one another and the retailers talking to the manufacturers and the distributors talking to all of them. There is still value in that face-to-face, that face-to-face notion, but that face-to-face time, I mean, but the you know, we can't do it. And this, it's going to be interesting to see if this becomes a sort of permanent adjustment or if this is still merely a blip.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, other changes in how we conduct business, you know, like Google's employees going remote, Google has said that the majority of their employees will remain work at home.
Right. And Apple is keeping everybody at work from home until June of 2021 at the earliest, obviously.
Right.
Although that time frame does look to be probably reasonable with the vaccine sitting. It remains to be seen. And other companies are doing the same thing. We've had a few companies leaving Silicon Valley. Tesla is relocating most of its people. I think Oracle is relocating its headquarters.
Oracle is going to what in the 90s we called Silicon Hills.
Yeah, in Austin.
Austin, yeah, in the hill country of Texas.
Yeah. And there's a VC fund, venture capital fund that has moved its headquarters, I think, to Florida. Okay. And so, you know, you're seeing a bit of, you're seeing a bit of an exodus. Now I'm thinking of my words here. I'm actually thinking about, my buddy, John Keat, who is essentially dancing on the grave of Silicon, of San Francisco in particular. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that, I very strongly do not think that a few companies leaving Silicon Valley is going to destroy Silicon Valley or even San Francisco.
No, but, no, but not at all.
But we are seeing, the ability for especially already established companies to not be here or to not be based here.
Well, and think back, Brian, to the I want to say it was the late 90s when the idea of telecommuting first came into existence.
Sure.
And we all thought, oh, everybody's going to start working from home. You know, we're only going to have 50% or less of our employees actually going to the office every day. And it never really took hold. But now it seems like it is. And the question is once we get the vaccine out, will this be the new normal or will we go back to the old normal?
I think that we will find a new normal that's not the normal of now.
I don't think everybody's going to stay at home, but I think we are going to see a lot more. I think it is going to change the landscape of business.
It is. Here's an interesting aspect of that I don't see talked about a whole lot. That is the power of the accidental meeting that Steve Jobs was so keen on. Are you familiar with this concept?
Okay. Yeah, but tell me more.
You're an excellent straight man, Jeff. Thank you. So Steve Jobs studied Bell Labs in the 50s and 60s. He studied the Bell Labs of the 60s, 50s and 60s. Right. And there was this enormous amount of innovation continually spinning out of Bell Labs. And so there was a lot of retrospective studying about how, you know, what was it about Bell Labs at that time that made that possible? Like, what was fostering this spirit and hub of innovation? Mm-hmm. And one of the things that was found, and this is something that Steve Jobs studied, and I learned all this in Walter Isaacson's Steve Jobs biography, but also in his book, The Innovators, which was a project that essentially stemmed out of his research for the Steve Jobs biography, and I recommend both books. They're fantastic. But anyway,
I haven't read The Innovators, but I did read his biography of Steve Jobs.
Innovators is fantastic. If you're interested in reading it, I'll send it to you.
That sounds great. Yeah.
Would you read it?
Absolutely.
That's fantastic. I'm going to send it to you. So
okay, cool.
The thing about Bell Labs was that all of these people from different disciplines and different jobs were essentially all housed together. Not housed, but officed together.
Right.
And so you had engineers running into, you know, designers, running into scientists, running into different scientists, and like, you know, just in the hallways. Because they'd bump into each other and they'd talk. And over time, different ideas were being brought, different ideas from outside of the core discipline were being brought to tackle problems and, you know, and tasks that that people had, and where normally like engineers might only associate with other engineers because they're all housed together. Now, all of a sudden engineers had all these, you know, sort of, you know, fanciful ideas, like, well, hey, you know, Have you thought about doing this, or, you know, what about trying that? And the result was you get all this innovation. So Steve Jobs had the Pixar headquarters designed to foster these kinds of innovations. I'm sorry, accidental meetings, where the engineers and the animators and the artists and the IT guys would essentially be brushing shoulders frequently. And then the same thing was brought to bear on Apple Campus 2.0, the Apple Park, which mm-hmm. was also designed to foster those same kinds of accidental meetings. And the thing about working from home and I've been working from home for 22 years now. And you know, it's a gift and a curse. But the thing about working from home that you don't get is those accidental meetings. You don't run into the engineer on your way to the bathroom.
Right.
And I'm
at least you hope not.
Well, you know, yeah, theoretically, yeah, right. And that is Marissa Meyer, who took over Yahoo, mm-hmm. right? Left Google and take over Yahoo. Did you catch that at the time? Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep,
one of the things that she did was end Yahoo's extensive work from home program. At the time I was thinking to myself, well, this kind of runs directly contrary to this thing that the rest of Silicon Valley is embracing, because Google designed some of its headquarters and various properties in Silicon Valley mm-hmm. to also foster these accidental meetings. And Facebook did the same thing. They were basically all doing it because Apple did it, and Apple did it because Steve Jobs had figured it out, or, you know, paid attention and gravitated towards this idea. And here was Marissa Meyer bucking that trend. And I thought to myself, well, that seems kind of foolish. But I just recently was listening to a story on NPR about that decision. And apparently she did that because there was no accountability in Yahoo's work from home program. So there were people who essentially literally did nothing. And so she ended it not because she wanted to end work from home. It's because she wanted to get some accountability built into the system. And the only way to do that was to start over from scratch.
Sure.
So that's interesting. But the point, interesting to me at least, and the point is that these meetings can't happen when we're all working from home. And I am sure that a big part of Apple's success are these accidental meetings. And probably, you know, as much as I don't like Facebook, you know, I'm sure the same thing is true for Facebook. I'm sure it's true for Google. I'm sure it's true for any company that has that does foster that sort of environment. And is that going to end up being a price we pay for everybody working from home?
That's a good question. I mean, we do have tools that can help bring us back together a little bit, but it's nothing like what has happened in the past, where, you know, running into someone in the hallway.
Yeah.
We have tools like Slack and Microsoft Team or whatever it's called.
But that's different. It's different from having a meeting.
Right. It's much different because, you know, how often does someone just randomly ping me on Slack and say, hey, what do you think about this? And the answer is almost never.
Right.
It's almost never. Well, you know, that has to be a forced meeting. It's not an accidental meeting.
Right. And those accidental meetings are, you know, along the lines of, hey, what are you working on? Oh, I'm doing such and such, you know, and just the unintended, unplanned, unpurposeful exchange of ideas that happens from that. And happening like when those meetings are happening hundreds of times per day, where people who maybe don't know each other are, you know, in the elevator together, or, you know, entering the bathroom together, or whatever, you know, hitting the water fountain together. Mm-hmm. That's what we're talking about. And everybody working from home decreases those accidental meetings.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, while I'm sure that working from home, you have to balance that against, you know, just baseline corporate greed where, holy crap, are you telling me that we can save $100 million a year by not putting everybody in the office?
Right.
Well, let's do that. I mean, that's certainly going to be a driver towards allowing more and more work from home. And of course, there are some people who love work from home. Yeah, I don't know.
I love it sometimes, but you know, I definitely see the value in the accidental meeting idea, and just swapping stories and talking to people about what you're working on or what you're trying to learn.
Yep.
You know, during my 3-year break from technology, I learned so much more just by sitting down and talking to people face to face.
Sure.
Than I ever did when I was, you know, sitting at my computer all day.
Sure.
Would I go back and do that all over again? No, probably not. It served its purpose. It allowed me to grow and expand in ways that I really needed to
make the most of that situation. Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, it's, but if I could find a way that I could have these accidental meetings, even in, you know, the way I'm working now, that would be a wonderful thing.
Yeah, it really would be. It really would be. And it is, working from home is a trade-off. I can testify to that firsthand.
Yeah.
It is a gift and it is a curse. And
It's great that my commute is only about 3 steps.
Yep.
But, you know, on the other hand, it's a lot of isolation.
Yep.
It's a lot of alone time.
Yep.
And, you know, it's very difficult to find those instances where you can get a kind of symbiotic relationship with someone else in a different field.
Here's what I think is going to end up being the best case scenario. So first of all, it appears that there are people who thrive working from home and people who do not.
Mm-hmm.
So that's that. There have already been some studies of that that have been done. I was listening to a really interesting NPR story recently about some research on this topic before the pandemic. And I'm sure that research is going to continue, but it appears as if there are people who thrive and people who do not, and people who love it and people who do not love it. And so what I'm thinking is the best case scenario may simply be that companies find that they can operate just fine with more people working from home. But at the same time, the vast majority of companies will probably still keep some form of office space, both for collaboration and convenience.
Mm-hmm. I think that one of the keys to being able to thrive while working from home is that you have to love what you're doing.
Sure.
You know, because working from home is great for me, but there's a definite trade-off. You know, I don't keep a normal 9-to-5 schedule. My schedule fluctuates based on what I'm doing and who I'm working with remotely.
Okay. Gift and a curse.
You know, I can have a day where my day goes from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Or I can have a day where I start at 8 a.m., and I take a break, and then I'm at it again from 6 p.m. to midnight.
Right.
And if I didn't love what I was doing, and there's days where I'll put in 16 to 18 hours straight. And if I didn't love what I was doing, that would just, it would be all bad.
Of course.
It would drive me crazy. I can say that.
No, you cannot say that. But that's okay. No one heard it because I beeped it out.
Okay.
Because you made me beep it out.
Sorry.
That's okay. I hate you now, but that's cool.
Well, hey, at least I'm not dropping the F-bomb like I'm pretty sure someone else has done a couple of times on this show.
No doubt. All right. For those keeping score at home, at this particular moment, Bitcoin is at $27.89. It's up $9 in the last 40 seconds. So volatile. It's very volatile.
And to clarify that's $20,789.
Correct. Sorry.
Not $2,789.
Correct. Thank you. Appreciate that. No problem. All right. So first of all, let me play this. And that is this week's Apple Context Machine. If you have anything to comment on, add, or question, you can write me at acm@macobserver.com. Our bandwidth is provided by Cashfly. The basis by Boom, recorded just for TMO. Jeff, I appreciate you being on the show this week.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's been fun.
And I would once again like to thank the excellent folks over at BetterHelp for sponsoring the show. And remember that you can get 10% off of your first month by visiting our sponsor at betterhelp.com/ACM. And everybody, we'll see you on the next show. And I very much appreciate it.